Thank you very much. Libby gave a nice background for my presentation, so I appreciate that. I am Katie Ellis. I'm the Tobacco Program Manager of the Marion County Public Health Department in Indianapolis, Indiana. I am doing this presentation for one of our personnel at the State Department of Health in Indiana, who can't be here because she's at home with a brand new baby. So I'm happy I'm here and happy that she's there, I guess. So, anyways, this is protecting those who served, and we're going to look at it from the Indianapolis experience. So before I get started, I do not have any relationships to disclose. So kind of an overview of what I'm going to be covering today. Some background as far as where this partnership started. A big thing that we need to cover is how the statewide and local laws in Indiana are affecting our work with veterans clubs. I'm going to also cover a statewide training that was given on working with veterans and military personnel in the context of tobacco control. Also, a toolkit that we received out of that. I will go over some of the resources in there. Hit on a couple of case studies of some direct work that we did with veteran organizations in Indianapolis, and then discuss some of the continued veteran outreach and partnerships that we are working on now in Indianapolis. So to begin, so this initiative to work with our veterans organizations really came from the Indiana State Department of Health Tobacco Prevention and Cessation Commission. So that just explains what the Tobacco Prevention Cessation Commission is and what they aim to do. And if you see from their mission statement at the very bottom, one of the major areas they look to eliminate minority health disparities related to tobacco use and emphasize prevention and reduction of tobacco use by minorities, pregnant women, children, youth, and other at-risk populations, which military and veteran populations are considered an at-risk. As Libby was explaining, they do have a higher rate of tobacco use than average civilians. And then in Indianapolis, the Smoke-Free Indy Coalition is the coalition that has taken on this initiative. We're working with veteran organizations to encourage them to pass smoke-free policies within their different groups. So Smoke-Free Indy is a coalition of state and local public health organizations, community-based organizations, physicians, businesses, schools, the faith community, and Marion County residents dedicated to reducing secondhand smoke, tobacco usage, and tobacco initiation through education, prevention, and advocacy. One of our favorite events every year is St. Patrick's Day, so that's a picture of us there. This is just kind of a breakdown of some of the major partners in the Smoke-Free Indy Coalition. We have several local partners, Indiana Latino Institute, Indiana Black Expo, the Minority Health Coalition of Marion County Public Health Department, St. Florian Center. Some of our national partners that we are lucky enough to have as part of our coalition would include American Lung Association, Cancer Society, American Heart Association, Campaign for Tobacco for Kids, and Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights. So we have always struggled with veteran engagement. I think a lot of that has to do with this not knowing how to approach military and veteran populations. There is that kind of perception that they fought for us. How can we tell them not to use their tobacco products? But we know that that's important to help them in not using that. And we also wanted to see them protected with our state and local laws. And so as part of that, we really did try and engage some veterans and military personnel in this. However, we kept on running up into a major roadblock with our mayor in Indianapolis. He is actually a veteran. He's a former Marine and was very, very much against having anything that had to do with including veteran organizations or private clubs in our local law. So that was something that we definitely struggled with. And even when we would find veterans or military personnel that supported, they weren't willing to talk publicly. However, as you can see, we did have a few veterans that were willing to publicly speak out against, you know, not including veterans clubs in the local ordinance. And were able to get some different issues from that. Unfortunately, we did not get it completely covered. However, the statewide law and the local law, and I'll have the local laws break down in a second, did decide to compromise and create a exemption, but have some requirements that private clubs and veteran organizations had to meet. So as you can see, this is a statewide law that was passed in the spring of 2012. It's a very kind of cumbersome requirements and can be confusing. So they must be exempt from federal income taxation, must hold a beer, liquor, or wine retailer's permit, must provide food or alcohol beverages only to bona fide members and guests, but anybody can be a guest, so it's kind of confusing there too. Provide ATC, so the State Alcohol and Tobacco Commission, with meeting minutes documenting that through a majority vote of its membership, it has elected to allow smoking. They also needed to provide ATC with floor plans indicating that the business provided a separate enclosed area, but not, you know, separate enclosed area that is adequately ventilated, but there was no real definition of what adequately ventilated meant. And as we know, that's typically not going to happen if they have shared ventilation systems, to prevent migration of smoke into non-smoking areas. So essentially that meant put a door on it and you're good. And also the other requirement on that was that no person under the age of 18 could enter those designated areas at any time. So that was the statewide law. It also then allowed that any place that our local law was stronger, it would supersede that. So our local law was a lot simpler, but as far as, you know, what the requirements were, it wasn't as kind of restrictive in many areas, except that we required that they provide notice by September 1st, 2012, whereas the state law would allow them to kind of vote at any time and then re-vote every 2 years whether or not they were going to allow smoking. So kind of a rolling process at the state, where ours did require that they do submit that by September 1st, 2012. Unfortunately, there is confusion, and definitely between the different enforcement agencies at the state and the local level, that has made that very hard. But with all of that being said, what kind of came out of this is that we realized that we needed to do our job in going and educating and helping to kind of encourage these organizations to adopt smoke-free policies within their clubs. So on June 20th of 2012, the Indiana State Department of Health did host a statewide training. They brought in several Indiana leaders and national leaders in working in tobacco control with military and veterans. So from Indiana, we had Major General Martin Umberger from the Indiana National Guard, who kind of gave the kind of basis for Indiana. And then we had Captain Lee Mandel, who is a command flight surgeon for the Naval Safety Center, who really did a lot of that kind of background in how tobacco has been very ingrained in military, and then kind of some of the initiatives that they are attempting to do at the national level that have, you know, not gained much support from Congress, but again, where we could be influential in helping to get those going. And then Colleen Hayden, who is with project manager with Project Uniform, which is working with military personnel on this issue in California. And she did a great presentation on cultural competency, so how we can work within this population, how we can get around some of our fears and insecurities in going in and working with veterans and military populations. So out of that, we did receive a veteran toolkit. So this gave us some different resources, some background information so we could feel very well-versed in what the kind of historical perspective was of tobacco in the military, some information about the scope of tobacco use among military personnel and veterans, and then also some of the current tobacco efforts in military and veteran affairs, and then ways that we could work with military and veteran populations, and some tips and skills on doing that. So here's some of the different tools that we got of those are resources. We, of course, cessation resources, so the military resources and veterans affairs, the Department of Defense's use resource was the You Can Quit Too, which is Quitline and online resources, and then the Indiana State's tobacco Quitline, which is 1-800-QUIT-NOW, which a lot of different states do use as well. Some different facts health effects of secondhand smoke, a really great key informant interview guide that can be used when we go in and talk with members of veteran organizations, and then some talking points to go along with that, how to come to kind of combat those things where people say, you know, I fought for my right to smoke, you can't take that away from me, how we can say that without just being, it's not your right to smoke, you know. So better ways to do that, to be sensitive to their feelings. Also a survey to use in these organizations, and then, again, a nice fact sheet about tobacco use among veterans and military personnel. And then included was also the letter from the National Commander of the VFW in 2006 that did encourage veteran organizations to adopt smoke-free policies within their posts and legions. So now into some of the case studies. The first one was American Legion Post 34. This is, I actually personally worked with this commander. I met him at an Earth Day celebration in 2011, so prior to our local and statewide laws. And his post is located in Broderpool, which is near one of our universities and is really considered kind of a cultural and bar district. So he had some issues with that and competition between those. And was also concerned because his post was losing money, because they just couldn't get the young veterans in. And one of his thoughts on that is that, you know, they don't want to bring their families into a place that is smoking. And so he really wanted to see that there was an even playing field that covered all workplaces, that the veterans organizations were not left out of that. Again, he was not willing to publicly speak out about that, but he did send a letter to the mayor of Indianapolis encouraging that. So in my follow-up with him, last summer, they did vote to go smoke-free. Unfortunately, it was too little too late, and they were not able to overcome those financial difficulties and have since had to close that actual post. They still are organized, but just were not able to afford to stay there. They are looking at reopening other properties, but his biggest thing that he kept saying was, you need to get this law strengthened to make it an even playing field. He wants to see all places covered. You know, we are very close to a lot of other cities that don't have a similar law, you know, or even just those gaps in the state and the local law that have allowed for this. So he just wants to see that covered. And then the next one was American Legion Post 249. This is in our UNWA, or United Northwest area. It is a predominantly black area, and this was a partnership that was begun between the Indiana Black Expo and Post 249. One of the members at the Indiana Black Expo had a good relationship with one of the members at Post 249, Lee Martin, and she did invite him to attend the statewide training, and out of that, he really decided to kind of take on this issue within his organization, and he asked our representative, India Anderson, at IBE, to come with him and do a presentation to their members and leadership. After that presentation, the members of that organization did vote to prohibit smoking at their post. They did, again, partnered in 2012 for a presentation on that, and this post is still going strong and is enjoying not being smoking in there. And this is just a letter that he wrote encouraging other veteran organizations to adopt similar policies in theirs. And then just to kind of finish up talking about some of the veteran outreach that we have done and that we're continuing to do in Indianapolis. This is just it's a slow-moving process. We are definitely working on it. We're finding different ways to get connected with veteran organizations, military organizations. We've attended the Indianapolis Veterans Day Parade and done some outreach there. We've gone to work fairs for veterans at the Indiana State Fair, have visited the local Veterans Administration Hospital several times. We also subscribe to different newsletters, follow different veteran organizations' social media to kind of see what things are going on, what things we can access and get into so that we can be interfacing with this population. Another thing that we've been able to do, we've been able to do a presentation to commanders of all of the American legions in Marion County. Haven't had a lot of follow-up from that, but we're going to continue to try. And then doing some more personal outreach, which is where we've kind of definitely started to see where some of the gaps between the state and the local law are causing confusion and frustration in these groups. And then the last thing that I'm going to end on is a new partnership that we've created with the Richard L. Rodebush VA Medical Center in Indianapolis. We're very excited. They are in the process of implementing a smokeless campus policy, and you'll notice that it's smokeless and not smoke-free because, again, this is a law. It was the Veterans Health Care Act of 1992 that does not allow veteran medical facilities to be completely smoke-free or to eliminate tobacco use on their campuses. So the best they can do is that they can go to only allowing one designated smoking area on the entire campus. They can't actually prohibit it, which is kind of frustrating because all of the other, this is actually really close to, what, 3-4 other hospitals in our kind of medical area in Indianapolis. So all the rest of those hospitals do have smoke-free or tobacco-free policies on their campuses. And this one can't, and one of the consequences of that is that they're finding people from some of the other hospitals are coming onto their campus and smoking. So not only are they having to deal with their populations, they're getting all the people from these other hospitals going onto that too. So, so this is the first step that they are taking, and so essentially, yes, there's going to be one designated smoking area. The first step of that, though, is that, and the most kind of aggressive part, is that they're not going to allow any inpatients to leave to smoke. And so as part of that, they needed to really kind of develop some partnerships to help with cessation promotion, not only for inpatients, but outpatients and visitors as well. And so I was able to reach out to them and get a connection. And so it's a very new partnership. I just met with them last Thursday, and we're in the process of helping them put together some cessation kits. They're hoping that the big initial rollout will be on Great American Smokeout, so we're going to go and assist with that too. So we're just very excited about having that partnership and continuing our work and trying to bridge our way into working with this population. So, and that's that. And some acknowledgments of all the different partners that have helped with this. So, thank you.
So the question was envisioning a smoke-free military, what are the most sort of fruitful options out there? Well, one thing is that the Air Force actually has, in their tobacco control policy, they state that the goal is a tobacco-free Air Force. So that's a great sign. They don't actually have a lot of, they don't have a plan to implement that completely, but that they have that as a goal is really important. I think there's been, partly because of some of the work our team has done and also some news reporting, there's been some push, some news about the pricing policy in military commissaries, and that's something that Congress was very involved in being insistent about. So I think that there might be some action in the future on that. I mean, and Congress is really where, especially like an organization like APHA could help, by testifying on behalf of whatever tobacco control policies are needed. I'm looking at my co-author here to see if she has any brilliant ideas. but I mean, mainly I think we need to sort of be in position to like support the IOM report to start thinking about this, as an idea, and be prepared to support the military personnel as they start coming out with these plans, and I think that that is on the agenda for a lot of people in the military, a lot of the military health people. About a third of military personnel who use tobacco start after they join the military. Yeah, pricing comes up a lot. I mean, in studies that have been done, people frequently mention the pricing, you know, as giving this real signal that it's something that tobacco use is something the military approves of. You know, you can buy it in the commissary, in the exchange, on the shop pets, you know, all over the base, basically, and generally at prices. They're supposed to only be 5% lower than the lowest prevailing civilian price, but that policy is not well enforced. It's not well defined, and it's not well enforced, and so sometimes those savings are really large, and so that's a big message. And then there's a lot of socialization in the military, you know, around smoking, and so that's sort of a cultural issue that needs to be addressed.
Well, so outside the subs, what kind of restrictions are there on bases about where people can smoke or not?
Well, you can't smoke in federal buildings or cars, and so that's pretty much, you know, all buildings on a military base. They generally have smoking areas, so they are restricted to outdoor smoking areas, except there is smoking in housing. There are various policies. There are a lot of different policies that there are overarching DOD policies. There's also policies for each service, and there are base policies. So there's this, you know, huge mishmash of policies at all different levels. Let's see, what are you saying about? So housing is still an issue. And now the Navy hospitals, which frequently have separate grounds than other Navy bases, they are have a policy of being completely smoke-free, all Navy medical facilities. So that's good.
Are you using the word smoking and tobacco interchangeably, or
is it smoking? Right. There is a lot of use of chewing tobacco, spit tobacco in the military, yeah, and a lot of dual use as well. So the smoking rates I was giving, that is just smoking, so you'd have to add the chew on top of that, yeah.
Really?
And mostly because our compliance rates, I think, are really low. They're not being issued tickets. So I'm just wondering if you have any compliance information.
So in terms of compliance and enforcement, I wasn't able to get that at the state level. I spoke to some people at LA County, and they said, you know, they're not actively going out to seek these smokers. So it's more of the, yeah, there have been media campaigns. California is really good with doing a lot of these campaigns, but it was really around the time when they were talking about the law that there was a lot of awareness. There was, you know, newspaper articles, and it was always on the news, and people were talking about it so much that it kind of became a norm in California, this is going to happen really soon, and a lot of people were for it, and so in that way, there hasn't really been much enforcement, to be honest. I haven't heard of anyone actually checking on that, but yeah, like I said, I am interested in seeing what the main rates would be like, because, you know, California kind of shocked me, to be honest.
So, Manel, while you're here, I had a question about So as you saw the rates of exposure in cars declining, was there any evidence that kids' exposure was shifting to other venues? Was there, they more exposed in homes or other places where they...
Yeah, home exposure has actually gone down in recent years, again, with the secular trends of, you know, people don't want to smoke in the home as much because there's so much talk about it. And so in California, we saw rates decreasing, just not at the same rate as the cars. So I feel like, in a way, the policies reaching out to other venues in a positive way for youth because they're just exposed to tobacco or smoking less, not necessarily tobacco.
And do you have comparisons between California and the other six states and Puerto Rico?
I don't have that data at the moment. I was only able to look at the National Youth Tobacco Survey. But if anyone does, I would love to talk to you afterwards. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
A question about the cars. Mm-hmm. Does that only apply to, like, private-owned vehicles? Or is that, like taxis, buses, and, like, sort of, like, public transportation? And is that something, like, that maybe, like,
yeah, that's a really good question. When it was put into effect, it was really for personally owned vehicles, but I know that different local areas have different policies within California, so if anyone can speak about that, but I don't believe it's like it's just an overarching in the cars, but I think public transportation in most places in California restricts smoking now. So California doesn't allow indoor smoking in the workplace, and that counts as a workplace. Yes.
Can I ask, how did California come up with 17 and how did Maine come up with 16?
Well, ours is actually under 18, so any youth, that's how the legislation. So I said 17, but I meant 17 and younger. I apologize. Yeah. Do you want to answer the Maine question?
More about the...
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's one of the funny things about policymaking, right? I mean, you follow other existing policies, but again, Maine was ahead of the game, and so however it came out, you know, other people are going to follow
so
it.
So often it's a result of compromise and
yes.
giving and horse trading and different things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ruth?
Yeah, well, I was really just so struck by your talk about Indiana, and it's so fabulous that you're doing this work with veterans groups. I was also just floored by how many loopholes your state law has.
It's Indiana, not California.
Yeah. It's really shocking,
yeah.
You know, and I'm wondering, you know, what you see the chances are of getting a really, you know, effective state law on this in the future, because clearly you can be going around working with veterans for
yeah.
forever, but if you've got a state law like that, it's a horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, that's not the only place that our state law has a lot of loopholes. A big one is, you know, we don't cover bars on that. Casinos is a huge one for us. That's a big, big one that we really want to see covered. As far as what the likelihood, we have a very conservative legislature right now, and probably not in the near future. Our hope is that, yes, someday we will see this strengthened. Really, though, where the work is happening is, you know, we're lucky that we aren't preempted in our local communities. So really, where we're trying to focus the work right now is getting really strong local policies. And we are not preempted. No. We are not preempted. So we are lucky in that. In that manner, so that we can get some of these local communities. So we're hoping that we can get more of a groundswell of local communities passing stronger laws in the state, so that we can get them covered. And then maybe that would push the state to do that too. So yes.
Here in Massachusetts, we have an equally bad loophole for private clubs, but cities and towns can go further. So we have 55 cities and towns that have banned smoking in private clubs. Early on, it was because restaurants and bars came forward and complained
yep.
that the private clubs were acting like public bars
yep.
where they're But what we're seeing now is a lot of times either they've kind of gone smoke-free in their own, so the health agent calls around and sees who they're smoking, and says to the one remaining private club, "Do you mind if we think you were smoke-free?" I'm like, "No, it's okay." Or the club comes to the Board of Health and says, "We can't decide amongst ourselves about going smoke-free. If you do it, we'll make you the bad guy, and we'll abide by it."
Yeah, and that's a lot of times what you get. I mean, people saying, "We want you to be the bad guy and do this for us. We want it, but we don't want to do it." So
that's a long time public service, isn't that the role?
Yeah, yeah.
The chance of this ever happening at the state level in Massachusetts is zero.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not willing to say zero in Indiana yet, but it's not a very strong likelihood right now, at least. So, yep.
Christine, I had a question about your qualitative research. I think you said that your either the owners or the employees felt like they had been excluded from the process, and I'm just curious if you can elaborate a little bit on that, and if you had given any thought to how you might have involved them more. Is somebody who's very interested in kind of a community-based participatory approach, how to pull people in from the beginning?
Yeah, we did try to approach. There was a bar and restaurant association, local. Sorry. we did try to approach the Bar and Restaurant Association. So we wanted to include them in the discussions at the table, but that person was not local. It was interesting. He had come in from Atlanta and was acting for the local, because I don't think the local was as organized. And so we really had no point person to work with, but we did do outreach initially to let all the bars know that this was on the table, and we wanted to welcome discussion. So they were able to, at some town hall meetings, to really relay their concerns, particularly about business loss and revenue, because we were going through the recession we're in recession, and so that was a big concern for them. And we really wanted to allay their fears as much as possible. In the media campaign and the education campaign that we did, we offered on-site cessation classes for their employees, because they have no insurance, most of them. And so to help them to quit smoking, we really wanted to do that for them. So we did try to reach out to the bars and restaurants. And what's nice is that some of our most adamant opponents, to the ordinance, have now become our most ardent supporters, because they're finding personally how beneficial it is for their own health, for their staff. They don't see as many absences.
Well, I think that's really the typical experience. I mean, they realize that, A, they have a very small proportion of their clientele who smokes in the first place, and even of those, many don't want to be exposed in the first place. And of course, they can save a lot of money on insurance costs and cleaning costs and all the things that you talk about. So I'm curious, is it other people have experience
for Dr. Gibbs?
I'm not a doctor. I'm not a doctor.
Is your initiative a valid initiative or an ordinance initiative?
It was an ordinance.
How did you not fall into the same trap that Indiana, California fell in and keep from getting the ordinance watered down?
Oh, we were, good question. We were following the Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights model policy, and we basically said, if you don't give us the entire thing, we will come back until we get it. Because we realized from other cities' experiences that if they went with a weak, ordinance, they would end up doing more work to complete it in the end, which
all... So you stuck with them all around the United States?
Yes. Yeah, and typically that's...
And I'd say we did too, and in the end we were basically out of the conversation, and they just decided, we're going to do this because the community wants it, and we're going to do it.
It's all about community will.
Then what were the differences in the dynamics?
Yeah, I don't...
Well, we had a lot of community will. That was when we had a supportive mayor, too.
Yeah.
When you have support from the mayor, it makes it easier for that to happen. Initially, he wanted exemptions, but we were able to have a you know, real discussion about how it's going to affect community health, and so, and he was willing to support that. So,
does anybody else have examples of how you involve kind of participants in your work to ensure that those voices were heard from the outset? Yeah. Right, and that's the role of some of us at the national level, is to try to do that, is to bring those folks together and to facilitate those conversations through, we have national partners meetings, and we have training and technical assistance sessions at A&R and the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and you know, a lot of the voluntary organizations you're working with are trying to help facilitate those conversations. So,
we did the bar hop here in Boston here in the US.
About the money that the tobacco industry spends to lobby, and that's why it's not illegal. So, right. Any last question or comment? Benjamin's parting action. So, exactly, right. So, let me reiterate, as I said at the top, I'm a governing counselor with the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Other Drugs section. That section brought this session to you. And we are always, always, always recruiting new people to get involved in many different roles in the section. So if you have an interest in that, please see me or one of the rest of us. Everything from reviewing abstracts that got us this fine session today to serving on the section council, working on our newsletter or our website, staffing our booth here at the conference or planning the program for next year or a whole host of things. So if you have any interest in getting involved, please see myself or Ann Mahoney in the back or drop by our booth. Our booth is number 957 B5 in the exhibit hall. Feel free to invite you. If you haven't seen this yet, you can pick up a copy of our own section program so you don't have to lug around the whole book. You can just get the ATOD events in this that's available at the booth, or I have a few copies here if you want to get them. One of the things to call your attention to is the awards ceremony for this section. That's tomorrow night at 6:30 in room 104B, right next door here. We'd be glad to have all of you come and hear about our new awardees, to get some free food and drink, and just to mix and mingle with others in the section and hear about all the great things that we're doing. So I definitely would invite you and all your friends. We won't have a screener at the door to make sure you're a section member, because we want all of you to come. So feel free to drag whomever you're hanging out with tomorrow afternoon. Finally, there's an opportunity if you want to evaluate this session on the mobile app. For those of you who've downloaded that, you can evaluate the session. We'd be glad to get your feedback on that. So if you have any other questions, you know, feel free to just catch me afterwards, and I'm glad to try to field those. So please join me in thanking our great panel this afternoon.